the other week I reread Adaptation and Natural Selection, and as I was reading it, I was and thinking about this meeting coming up and the article I want to write, I really became curious about sort of how sort of the history behind the book, your own personal history, in a sense. You mentioned a little bit in the edition I have how you started to think that such a book would be necessary. And I was actually wondering, did the ideas that that you were expressing in that book, were they already emerging in the work you had been doing previously on senescence and so on? Or is it sort of the other way around?
Well, I think there was, I think my, let me just say, I'm not sure where it started, but certainly my original interest in senescence, I mean, I can identify that very easily. That's, I went to a lecture at the University of Chicago in 54 or 55, somewhere in there, from Emerson. Forget his first name. I'm lucky to remember his second name. At any rate, he was a very famous and at that time rather well advanced in age professor at the University of Chicago, and I thought that his lecture was absolute nonsense. It was saying that getting old and dying is a good thing, that we're evolved to do that so that the we get out of the way so that the young people can go on with the maintaining the species. At any rate, that led to my Evolution of Senescence article. But also, in various ways, it was a general fallacy, what I would call a general fallacy at that time, was that evolution, the process of evolution, produced things that were adaptive for the species, the group, rather than adaptive for the individuals, mostly in competition with each other within the species, which is what I figured was really what was going on. But at the time, I was totally unaware that anybody had pointed out anything like that. I mean, I had not read anything by people like R.A. Fisher, and who was certainly of that opinion, although he didn't really stress it, as I think he should have. He really didn't stress the fallacy that so many people were indulging in. So at any rate, that's sort of what got me started. What I thought of as a widespread fallacy that ought to be corrected. Now, having gotten into it, I did discover that there were others who'd expressed perfectly correct opinions, like Fisher and others. But they were an extreme minority. Well, that's the reason I got busy at that book.
I mean, did people? I mean, in your generation, people who were getting their PhDs or who were young professors in the 50s, would you say that in specializing in evolutionary biology, would you say that you generally kind of shared the ideas that you were proposing, and that it was just sort of an older generation that was talking about, the sort of sense of this concept of the good of the species, or do you really feel like nobody was talking about these the way you were?
The kind of talking that I experienced was that, it was the same old story of organisms indulge in the reproductive activity so that they can assure the perpetuation of the species.
Mm-hmm.
And now that, of course, is a result of that activity. But if you look at the details, they're competing with each other for that reproductive process.
Mm-hmm.
Most obvious in male animals competing with each other for access to females and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, that's just one aspect of the general problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's the correcting what I thought of as a serious flaw in people's reasoning was my main motivation for that book.
Mm-hmm. I was struck by how I guess William Hamilton was coming up with some similar ideas at around the same time. It seems that there were sort of maybe some of these ideas were in the air. I mean, what was your sort of experience with that?
Well, my experience with, I mean, my what I think of it with respect to Hamilton is that I had an advantage in that I was 10 years older than he was and got started sooner. And for instance, my article on the evolution of senescence, it's really simple and naive compared to a few years later, he came up with a really detailed and mathematical treatment of the same phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, I mean, there were a few things in which I got there before he did, but when he came along, his works were much more advanced.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And really replaced mine as it should have been.
Mm-hmm. When the book adaptation of Natural Selection actually came out, how would you characterize the response that it received?
Well, it got mostly favorable reviews, and but I think that in a very few years, it the general attitude towards what natural selection accomplishes was essentially, I mean, most of the important people working on evolution agreed with me and made use of that attitude.
Mm-hmm.
That it's a matter of one individual in competition with another individual. It's not not organisms doing things for the survival of the species. It's for their own survival of their own genes in that species.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it was that's a sort of enviable a fate for a book to have to enjoy such a success.
Yeah, I somehow did it at exactly the right time, and it had the influence that I desired. In fact, it had it a lot sooner than I expected it to.
Hmm.
So, yeah, it was a very nice experience.
Mm-hmm. Did the ideas that you were bringing up in the book, did they sort of influence the way that you would work with the students that you then had? Were you trying to get them to focus on thinking about adaptations in the ways that you laid out? I mean, how would you sort of say the relationship is there between the book?
Actually, I've certainly used that idea in lectures and so on, although it was not, I mean, I didn't teach a course in evolution. I taught, at the time, let's see, 66, things were still fairly fairly new here at the university at Stony Brook.
Mm-hmm.
And really specialized. I didn't have graduate students until the 1970s.
Huh.
And really, I think there were courses in evolution and that sort of thing in which I participated. But by then, this was just 20 years after the book was published.
I've seen some places where people have discussed how some scientists who have been involved in what was once called sociobiology, and in some cases is called evolutionary psychology now, point to your book as kind of opening the way to this kind of study of behavior, in really picking up in the 1970s. When you started seeing sort of the rise of sociobiology, you know, the publication of E. Olson's book and so on, I mean, what was your reaction to it? I mean, did you feel that it was sort of following the sort of adaptationist program, or did you think that it was...
Well, I think in general there were things about Wilson's sociobiology book that I criticized.
Mm-hmm.
I think the book as a whole was a real important contribution. And most of the criticisms, really fanatical criticisms of it, were, I'm very much opposed to those criticisms.
Mm-hmm.
I think basically, ultimately, the criticisms come from people who are fanatical about human rights and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I should point out that I don't quite know how to put it, but I'll put it this way. It's the God is good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Even people who, they may classify themselves as atheists even, but they still have the idea that if not God is good, then Mother Nature is good, and mm-hmm. things that happen naturally are nice, they're good, they're acceptable philosophically and with respect to people's relationships to each other.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's wrong. I think... in fact, I have a publication, 10 or 15 years ago or something, called Mother Nature is a Wicked Old Witch. And people think that that's a horrible title. But I think, in fact, it's correct. If you look at what's going on in nature, it's just a series of horrors. And actually, Thomas Huxley, way back in 1890 something or other, pointed this out, that what goes on in nature is something that you have to try to avoid, not copy.
Mm-hmm.
And just look at the ratio of success to failure in just any group of organisms you can think of.
Mm-hmm.
And the failures are, they're extreme examples. So fish that produce millions of eggs, those new individuals, what proportion of them actually succeed in life? And I think our own species is an extreme example of a high level of success. So many of the children that are produced actually do survive and have perfectly acceptable lives thereafter.
Mm-hmm.
At least this is true nowadays. But back in the old Stone Age, it was not true. I think probably, the data I think indicate that maybe half the children born actually made it to adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, things were back in the natural human life and environment. Were pretty unpleasant
mm-hmm.
compared to today. So at any rate, I think it's essentially the God is good fallacy that has led people to take rather unfortunate attitudes towards biology.
I see.
But I think most people would think that my perspective on this is rather extreme.
Well, I mean, do you think that that looking at just sort of scientifically speaking, looking at behavior this way is legitimate, and in the sense of, I mean, is it possible to look at behaviors in humans or in other animals as you know, sort of breaking them down into these different sort of fitness increasers, as it were? What's your opinion on that aspect of it?
That's most of the behavioral patterns, the normal behavioral patterns we see are adaptive. They contribute to the fitness of the individuals showing those patterns. But the fitness, of course, is an extremely competitive process. And for every success, there are many failures. And even the successes may not be very pleasant. Look at, frequently cited example is something like lions, in which a male can have several mates and frequently has to fight off other males that want to compete with him for those mates. And if a new one takes over, this wasn't originally found in lions, but I think it's certainly true of lions. But
yeah.
It was originally found in a monkey that studied by Sarah Hurdy at the University of California.
Oh, yes, I was just agreeing. Langer's, right.
The monkeys, when a male took over a bunch of females, one of the things he did was try to kill their babies. And this, Sarah indicated that this was a natural behavior. Because obviously what it did was increase, it hurried the change in the female from lactation to ovulation. So that the females there that were held up by providing nourishment for their babies, that was a delay with respect to the male's reproduction. So he wanted to minimize that delay and kill the babies. And then the baby having been killed, the mother would was perfectly willing to accept him as a mate as soon as she her reproductive process got appropriate again. But at any rate, I think that like many other examples of this sort of thing, it's generally accepted now that males frequently kill babies so as to increase the accessibility of the female's reproductive capabilities for their own use, for the male's own use.
Something I was also wondering about reading Adaptation and Natural Selection again is I'm curious to know if you've had any kind of important changes in the way that you look at adaptation and evolution, if your views have changed in any particular way since the writing of that book.
Oh, I'm sure they must have, but I'm not sure I can think of a really important example at the moment. Maybe I'll think of something, but at the moment I can't.
Okay. If anything comes up while we're talking.
For example,
There's been...
Let me point the point out something here. There was a reprint of that book, and somewhere in the, there's a brief introduction that I wrote when the thing was reprinted.
Yeah, that's...
I pointed out two or three things that I thought were
okay.
Wrong in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And, but at any rate, I think the general philosophy of the book is something I'm still very much in favor of.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's been a fair amount of work on group selection in recent years, such as looking at group selection in hominids or humans, for example.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what you think of that work, and you know if you think that there is an important evolutionary process that might be going on there. I mean, obviously, group selection was an important topic in adaptation natural selection.
There certainly is a process or several processes going on there. But I think that what goes on within a population, the competition among the individuals in a population, is enormously more immediately effective with respect to producing the evolution of that population than any other any of the more the broader kinds of selection going on. But I think my main focus of this criticism would be on the other Wilson.
David Sloan Wilson.
I'm sorry. Let me point out that I'm an Alzheimer's victim, and I keep forgetting names. Doris is writing down. Yeah, David Wilson, who is very much in favor of group selection in the sense of fairly local groups producing a greater amount of local reproduction and success compared to other groups that they might be considered in competition with. But these are within the same species. Now, I think that a higher level of group selection is enormously more important and has been largely ignored. We can identify, groups of organisms that were extremely common at one time and died out. Now, why did they die out? In the first place, was that extremely dominant sort of invertebrate group in the Paleozoic that the name of which will come to me, but they gradually died out and have almost totally disappeared. Now, look at this statistically. What's the probability that thousands of species, each independent, let's say, with respect to selection and survival and that sort of thing, what would be the likelihood that 900 and something would have died out? Unless there is some attribute of that group as a whole that provides a disadvantage relative to other groups that they're competing with.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that selection at the taxonomic level is something that should get a lot more attention.
So you feel that it's been relatively ignored by evolutionary biologists?
Yeah, I think it is.
Mm. Can you speculate on why people would not be paying much attention to it?
Well, no, I have trouble coming up with ideas of why people don't do things.
Oh, okay.
let me point out what I think is a spectacular example of that. Why do they so consistently ignore the fact that there is such a widely prevalent phenomenon of sex? Why are there all these species with males and females when in a very simple model, each of them would be twice as efficient if there were nothing but females? Now this, I mean, there are are examples of species in which males do contribute to the survival of offspring and that sort of thing. There are others in which they really contribute almost nothing. They just compete for the females, and having fertilized a female, that's the end of it. But yet, this problem, where a number of people back in the 70s and 80s were like Maynard Smith and me and several others who were very much worried about this and published about it.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, nowadays, there's hardly any attention to this problem.
Mm.
There was some attention most recently, 10 years ago or more, by Hamilton in England, except I think he was totally wrong as to why he explained the persistence of sexual reproduction. And in fact, I wrote a brief article on lamenting his death recently.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a brief paragraph when I say, why don't we, the excuse was, after having praised him at considerable length, I said, well, of course, you don't agree with that. Scientists don't totally agree with each other on everything. And I pointed out that I disagreed with him on sex. And I'll go on and more or less quote what I say, that in order to solve the problem of sex, what you do is consult an expert. And an expert is any organism that does it both ways, reproduces sexually and asexually. And I point out that my favorite example is a strawberry plant. They produce new offspring of exactly their own genotype, maybe a foot or so away from where they're living, and you can produce a potentially tremendously large clone of exactly the same genotype of these strawberry plants. But at the right season, they produce flowers and seeds. The seeds widely disperse, but each seed has half the genes of the producer of that seed, and the other half came from a pollen grain that fertilized that seed. And looking at the comparison of these two processes within that one species is the way to determine what sex is all about.
Mm-hmm.
But yet there's exceedingly little in the way of comparison of this sort,
mm-hmm,
in the literature. And, I would be doing this sort of thing. In fact, I tried to do this sort of thing. And back in the 70s and 80s, I had research proposals for this sort of thing, but they were always condemned by the National Science Foundation.
Mm.
So I ultimately gave up.
Mm-hmm. I see. And also on the subject of these sort of higher levels of selection, I'm so curious. I was looking over Stephen Jay Gould's last book, The Structure of Evolutionary Theory, and he seems to have very ambivalent ideas about your own work, praising you on the one hand and then attacking you on the other hand. I'm just sort of curious what you think of his ideas, particularly on the sort of higher levels of selection.
Well, I think he's a good example of an exceedingly bright and hardworking guy who was afflicted by the God is good fallacy and tried to show that organisms are doing things that are good. Now, this is obviously not a very accurate or a very meaningful statement, but at any rate, I mean, he and I mean, we get along fine. We've had dinners together and discussions together and so on, and we were good friends. But somehow or other, I keep discovering ways in which I think he's really misleading things with respect to the what's going on in evolution.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, let me just say though that I think he's a tremendously important contributor. In that, I suspect that there are, and especially in the near future, there will be an awful lot of important biologists who became important biologists because of his influence on them in his writings in the natural history journal and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, by and large, his contribution has been extremely important and in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Shifting gears just a little. I'm familiar with your work on evolution in medicine, and I'm curious to know what the origin of that particular line of research was when you sort of started working explicitly on that particular line of work.
Interesting question, and I think like so much else in the history of science and history in general, really, that there's a very chance sort of, I mean, very accidental sorts of developments. And okay, let me point out first of all that my paper on the evolution of senescence sort of got me interested in medical problems in general from an evolutionary perspective, but I had no intention of really getting into medical research or anything like that until I, just by chance, I spent a semester at the University of Chicago with who? I'm sure, yes, the University of Michigan. Fortunately, I have a wife here to some of the things I state. University of Michigan. Let me ask her, what's his name? No. The younger, the graduate student there? Well, it doesn't matter. At any rate, there's this guy who, in fact, he wrote what I think is the first article on the use of a Darwinian approach to medicine. Now, I mean, at any rate, it was explicitly that, and it came at a time when it caught my attention. Now, in retrospect, we can find other sorts of references to Darwin with respect to medical problems. But at any rate, and then shortly thereafter, at a dinner party, I ran into Randy Nessie,
mm-hmm.
a psychiatrist at the University of Michigan. And our interactions, our discussion, led to our collaboration in, first of all, just the article that appeared in the Quarterly Review of Biology. And then there was another coincidence sort of thing. A guy whose name, like most others, escapes me at Cornell, has a friend who wrote wrote articles in the New York Times. And her a woman whose name I will easily recognize when I read her articles. But anyway, she's a friend of his, and he told her, hey, you know, you really ought to talk about a Darwinian approach to medical problems, such as was discussed by Williams and Nessie in that article they published. Well, she did, and she published an article in the Science Times praising and maybe to some extent or describing and more praising than criticizing our article. And immediately, Randy Nessie and I, my collaborator and I, got a deluge of offers from publishers who said they wanted to publish a book on the topic. Now, most of them, I figure, were just nonsense. I mean, in fact, a lot of the wording of these things were pretty stupid. But, again, a tremendous coincidence. I happen to have a son who happened to be married to a woman who was an authority at for a publisher in New York, or something related to publishing. And she sort of chuckled and looked at looked at some of the letters I got and saw one and pulled it out and said, get this guy. She really approved of of Brockman as a kind of an agent for to connect authors and publishers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote to him and inquired as to what I ought to do. And as a result, Randy and I decided to produce the book on Darwinian medicine, or whatever it was called in its actual publication. So we wrote it, and it was published. So here again, there are lots of really casual events led to one of the books that we published.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that, in fact, was a let me just say that not only did that book get published, but it got translated and published in many other countries and languages, in some of which, for instance, this may seem like a strange combination, but I think that the concept of Darwinian medicine is now much more important in China and Norway and Italy than it is anywhere else, certainly than it is here. And why this should be is strange. For instance, in Italy, there was a big international meeting about this process that I and Randy attended. And there were statements in the literature to the effect that it has had a profound effect in Norway, our work is, well, I'm not sure exactly what happened there, but the claim is that it's really influential in medical education now. Now, this is not true in this country.
Do you think? This is similar to the question I was asking before. I'm curious about why you think about why people might be resistant to these ideas. Is it simply because medicine doesn't have a tradition of thinking in terms of evolution?
Yeah. In fact, one of the excuses one of the reasons I've heard is that in medical education in the United States, there's just no room to add anything to what's already there. And in every medical school, there's a staff that has things to do, and they're not going to be replaced in any sense by somebody else doing something else. So there's a considerable resistance to curriculum changes in American medical schools. At least this is the excuse I've heard.
Mm-hmm.
It's not until the professors retire and disappear that the possibility of another professor who might be influenced by the Nessie and Williams publications that would be possible.
Mm-hmm. Is there any particular research, any particular medical research that has come out recently that you think is a good example of the benefits of thinking about medicine in terms of evolution?
Well, I think the most conspicuous is the fact that so many of our pathogens, so many viruses and bacteria, evolve rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's certainly gotten a lot of attention. There are, well, another effect that I think really ought to have a lot of attention, but in fact the attention is very much the other way around, is in the, aging is the usual term nowadays. But anyway, as you get older, you get more likely to die. And I have a recent publication on this, saying, in effect, that the concentration on death is what ought not to be going on. That we should be looking at individuals' physiology as they get older, their capabilities as they get older.
Mm-hmm.
And if they die, well, then that's the end of the information that's relevant. And this was a lecture that I gave, and it was published by the Quarterly Review of Biology along with the two other lectures that were actually, this is when three of us, me and Maynard Smith and Ernst Mayr got prizes from Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
We gave lectures there. And all three lectures were published together in the Quarterly Review of Biology. But mine essentially was that modern gerontology is stupid. It's looking at death when it ought to be looking at the causes of death and the like my Alzheimer's problems, which isn't the cause of death, but it's something that it's an extremely important thing that happens when people get older,
mm-hmm.
along with deterioration of just about everything else. I mean, everything you measure in the way of anything you can quantitatively measure. In fact, I've got an example of this in that publication. What I did was for quite a few years I would get up not every morning but two or three times a week at least and run around the neighborhood and time the duration of my running.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it got too hot for that, I quit. I mean, that would be at the end of the spring, and then the fall I'd do it again and quit for the winter. But at any rate, this went on for quite a number of years. And I got averages for these different years. And the averages would be expected. This was in my late 40s and 50s, that sort of thing. Actually, I plotted it in that article.
Oh.
as a way of showing a rate of deterioration in an adaptive performance as you get older. Now, in the good old days, this would have meant that if I run away from a saber tooth, I'm less likely to get less likely to escape older than younger. I mean, this is, but at any rate, this is, I'm sure there's just a tremendous number of capabilities, of performances that can be quantified, like speed of running. I mean, the visual and hearing and sexual and fertility and all sorts of, and of course, resistance to many different kinds of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
They all deteriorate as you get older. And you can measure their rates and relate those rates to environmental problems and genetic aspects, the genetics of the individuals that show them.
Mm-hmm.
But whether, now, one of the problems, of course, is that the most that can ever be helped, the most that can ever be expected from this kind of study is that you may be able to find ways, dietary or other ways, that can retard the deterioration of some of these attributes. But the idea that there will ever be a pill that you can take that will stop your deteriorating as you get older, I think, is extremely unrealistic.
And I mean, does the evidence that has come out over the years, do you think it, I mean, does it, in terms of the evolutionary processes that produce this kind of deterioration, I mean, do you see any particular explanation sort of doing a better job than others? For example, selection on genes that enhance fitness at a younger age, which have a sort of a pleiotropic, you know, effect, have a negative fitness effect in later life, or?
Yeah, that, I think, is the ultimate reason for all this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. I see. This is sort of a general question. I mean, it's very interesting to me to read the work of people like yourself who began in the 1950s on thinking about evolutionary biology. I'm in my 30s, and so I'm, you know, as I've been writing about science, you know, I almost take it for granted that you can sequence genes or in a day or compute a phylogenetic tree in an hour with all sorts of characters in it, or we have all these sort of all these instruments and methods at our disposal now in terms of studying evolution. What is it like for you to sort of see the science be transformed over the years? When you were starting out, there was still, you know, relatively little sort of technology to assist you in terms of your work.
Yeah, well, yeah, things have changed quite a bit. I mean, in the first place, there are enormously larger number of scientists at work now than 50 or 60 years ago.
Mm.
And, of course, the technological advances have made tremendous differences in what can be accomplished in scientific research. But let me also say that I'm largely ignorant of an awful lot of this because I've been out of touch with so much of this for quite a few years now. I mean, obviously, the identification of DNA as genetic material is one of the big advances. It's widely recognized. Um, it's because, and I think it's gotten a lot more international than it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for instance, one of the obvious changes is that you really nowadays you seldom have to read anything, something in a language other than English.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in graduate school, this was, there was an awful lot of publications in other languages that you had to be able to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to pick a couple of languages, and the usual ones were French and German. That's what I worked on and somehow passed the tests.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this is no longer true.
Mm-hmm. Are there... are there particular areas of evolutionary biology that that you've been trying to sort of keep up to date with, or have you sort of just not been following the developments?
I think being really up to date on anything is something I can't claim.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, there are some things I've been more interested in than others, like. Applications to medical problems,
mm-hmm.
and behavioral problems, but I think even there, I'm way behind many other people.
Mm. Of these areas that you have been trying to keep up with, are there particular things that you find particularly exciting and promising for the future?
Well, I think I already mentioned one. People should be looking at sex.
Mm-hmm.
In what organisms do it, what don't, what do both sexual and asexual reproduction, there are obvious situations like... there are lots of organisms out there that only reproduce asexually. They never have sexual reproduction. There are species, and that's it. Well, there are exceptions here also, but it would appear that if you don't reproduce sexually, at least sometimes, you're much less likely to evolve into a different kind of organism, and you're much more likely to go extinct.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a group selection process very much at work, the value of sexual reproduction,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to asexual. That's certainly something that I wish would get more attention.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
No, I'm sorry, what was your original question?
Oh, I was just, I mean, you answered it. I mean, the kinds of topics that you find particularly interesting and promising in the future.
Well, that and, of course, the application of evolutionary ideas to medical problems.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think those are all the questions I have right now. I hope when the meeting comes, I'll be sure to introduce myself to you, and perhaps if you have a little free time during the event, maybe.
I'm sure I will.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're here, that'll be great.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm definitely coming. I'm really looking forward to it. I mean, indeed.
Okay. Well, and I'm looking forward to meeting you.
Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time.
You're certainly welcome, and I'll be seeing you.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.